You're about to listen to the Complete Developer Podcast, the podcast by coders, for coders, about all aspects of life as a developer.
I'm Will, the curmudgeonly experienced developer.
And I'm Beege, the optimistic newbie developer.
Complete Developer Podcast is supported by listeners like you. We are now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/Complete Developer Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Complete Developer Podcast. This week, we're talking about what developers need to know and think about logging. We'll first discuss why you should be doing better at logging than you are.
Because everybody sucks at it.
Followed by things to look for when looking at a logging framework. Next, we'll discuss why writing your own logging framework is probably not a good idea. And finally, we'll wrap up with a list of things to keep in mind while you're actually writing your logging code. But before we get started, Will, what have you been fighting this week?
Nothing.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm taking 3 days off this week because I lose them if I don't. Having done the consulting route for a while, I kind of got used to not taking a lot of days off. And so I accumulated them throughout the year. And then I got informed that, hey, you know, you got to do something with these. And, you know, they go away at the end of the year if you don't. And so I signed up and took the days off and then tried to figure out what I was going to do with them. And mostly I've done a lot of work around the house and all that, but you know, I am actually forcibly taking a day off tomorrow. So I'm getting up. I have to be in town at like 15 after 8 and
That's
I'm getting,
late.
Well, yeah, but I'm going and I'm getting a massage and then I'm getting a chiropractic adjustment. And then I've got some Christmas shopping to do. After that, I am going into a sensory deprivation tank for 3.5 hours. So, I do that periodically. It's a good meditation environment, you know, really dark, really quiet. You kind of get disconnected, I guess, from your body a little bit. And you get to be a brain in a vat for a while. Nobody can get to you, so you can actually sit and think.
Getting your Futurama on.
Yeah. So, I'm really looking forward to tomorrow, just, you know, kind of getting that nice forced break. And I'm going to try really hard when I get home not to do anything. We'll see how well that works. It's not really my nature. But yeah, that's what I'm doing. The other thing is I've been looking at our download numbers and seeing how they spiked over the past, what would you say, month or so, I guess? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the tail end of November was pretty elevated as well.
Yeah, well, apparently everybody enjoyed the episode with Erin.
Yeah.
When she was on. And so we're currently talking about getting her on for another episode. Thinking about maybe, you know, having her as a regular guest on the show, just talk about different topics and stuff, because, you know, she's a friend of ours. We get along well with her, and she
likes good beer.
She likes good beer, and she fit in with the
ambiance, as it were.
Exactly.
So how about you?
Well, I want to start off talking about something that you and I are doing. That is called Developer Launchpad. You guys might recall we've talked about being part of the Code Newbie organization and running the meetup group here in Nashville. Well, we actually broke off from the organization. Some people have asked about that, so I wanted to explain, you know, we still support their mission. I'm still going to be attending Codeland, which is their conference up in New York, on April 21st and 22nd. You can find out more about that at codelandconf.com. But they were going one direction. We kind of liked where they were, and so we decided to break off and do our own thing. Our mission with Developer Launchpad is to help developers launch their careers to the next level. We're also working on some training materials under the same name, and you can go to the website www.developerlaunchpad.com to sign up and receive weekly emails with coding challenges written for all levels of coders. At the end of the week, we'll send out the solution along with the next challenge. And on a personal note, found one of my favorite beers.
Yes,
recently.
You did.
We're drinking tasty. It now. It is. It is. I haven't had this since I moved to Tennessee. It's made in Louisiana, and it is Abita Andy Gator. Amazing. I've been fighting with JavaScript.
Which is why he needs the beer.
Yeah. Well, you've heard me complain about.
Let's be honest. You need to go straight to Wild Turkey with JavaScript dates.
Yeah.
There's nothing else that's good enough.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you've heard me complain about JavaScript dates. Well, I think we just need to be friends, JavaScript.
Yeah.
I recently discovered that JavaScript assumes all date times that come to it are in GMT. And then Angular, trying to be your buddy and help you out, converts...
I'm not that, your buddy, pal.
Yeah. Converts that time to your local time zone.
In the browser. Which is great when you have time that was recorded as server time that goes to the browser and... Half of your app says, hey, this is GMT. And the other half of your app, which is Angular, says, no, this is local browser time. And they're both wrong.
Yes. Yeah. It gets really tricky when you're around the midnight, like within that range.
Well, and you've got a very special time coming up here in a little less than 2 weeks also that it's going to make it even better.
Oh, yeah. Because
the year rollover will be
we've already tested
fun
that.
Times.
We've tested that, so we're good with that.
You know, it's kind of holdovers from an earlier age.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's that, and then there's all the crap around, like, Base64 encoding arrays and doing all the stuff you have to do to get data back and forth. Because I've had to do quite a bit with that, and it's just miserable. Because you can't figure out... I mean, like, if you're looking at a big wad of binary, you know, it's like, I have no visibility into what's actually wrong here. I don't know. And, I kind of think you had the same thing with the date. It's just, it's sad that this isn't better than it is. And they can't ever fix it.
Yeah.
Because stuff from 1993 is still out on the web.
Okay, if they fixed it, they'd break so much stuff.
Probably 95 or so because, you know, the whole, but still.
Yeah, the website I had up in 95 is still out there. No, it's not.
How is GeoCities these days? What neighborhood were you in? Oh, bad man. Memories. Ooh. Break out the blink tag. So, speaking of blink tags, I guess it's about time to hit the IoTs.
Let's roll the music. I have something fun for you to do with the IoTs this week. And this is to build a life-size BB-8 droid with household items. The tutorial uses household materials to build the body of the droid and an Arduino Uno to control it. The guy that wrote it actually built this as a gift for his father, who likes to collect Star Wars memorabilia and stuff. He even includes some videos in the tutorial, and it's actually a really inventive idea and kind of neat. So I'll have a link in the show notes. You guys can check it out. Who's talking to us this week?
We got an iTunes review from Zach Paris. He says, currently wrapping up a 12-month full stack boot camp at NSS here in town. That's Nashville Software School. Wish I had found this podcast months ago. Very informative and enjoyable to listen to. These guys are great. I've been recommending this podcast to everyone at school. Great job and thanks. Really appreciate what you're doing here. Keep it up.
Well, hey, Zach, thanks a lot so much for the great review. We really do appreciate that. Since you're here in town, we'd like to go ahead and extend an invite out to one of our meetups. Check out Developer Launchpad. Come visit us. Hang out. We do a social gathering and a code event where we kind of work on a challenge together as a group. But we've got some complete developer swag just for you. And guys, if you guys would like your own complete developer swag, leave us a review in iTunes or comment on the website or any of our social media. We're on Path and Tumblr, and we post all of our episodes to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+.
We're on Tumblr now?
Yeah, we're on Tumblr. So getting into the episode, what is the purpose of logging?
Well, there's several things, right, that you want to make sure you're able to do. The first is to provide routine diagnostic information when you can't attach a debugger to something. And can't is kind of a broad word because you might just not want to.
Yeah.
And this is especially helpful in production environments or QA environments where you're trying to test stuff out so you can actually see the sequence of events that happened. Because one thing that will happen when you have a debugger attached is you're changing the timing of the code. And so little weird timing issues that will happen in production will never happen there.
I know. I've discovered a lot of JavaScript promises issues because you throw in a debugger and it works all of a sudden.
Yep.
And that's kind of how I know it's a promises issue, is if I throw in a debugger and it works.
Right. And yeah. If you were logging, you wouldn't have to do that, right? That's, I think it was Linus Torvalds actually talked about this. He's like, you need to stop relying on the debugger so much because you miss stuff. And bear in mind, he's doing kernel development, right?
Yeah.
But it still holds. Basically, the idea being that when you are debugging, you're actually altering the program. You're altering the timing. You're altering how it reacts. And as a result, you're not necessarily debugging what you think you're debugging. Whereas if you're logging, that logging is always there.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why working in JavaScript, we use the console.log in our dev environment so we can look at the console and see what it's logging. But we use the debugger to either see if it's a timing issue.
Yeah.
Or see what the object is at a certain point.
To look at state at a certain point without having to dump it. But a lot of people really overuse their debugger and they don't log anything. And they're just like, oh, I'll just step through it. And
really?
Yeah. You know, or they'll set a breakpoint and run to that breakpoint and then step through, you know, three or four lines and then go. And that works okay. But when you don't have the logging in there and there is a timing issue, you're just stuck. Because what are you going to do? Go back and insert hundreds of lines of code?
I actually use breakpoints as a test to see if it is a...
If it's hitting it.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things. It's like, all right, I'm having this issue. Let me throw in a debugger or a breakpoint. And I do that and it works after I run through it, after hitting the breakpoint. And I'm like, okay.
Now you know it's async.
Yeah.
Something async is happening.
Exactly.
Yeah. Another reason you do logging, and this is one people don't think about, is to provide proof that the app is not in a zombie state. This is especially important for stuff that's running, you know, headless.
Yeah.
I do this a lot with Windows services where it's like, hey, every 5 minutes, write a message out to the log that says, yep, still here. Because it's possible if the service is not built correctly that it can actually, you know, it can actually get into part of the loop that it's not going to ever write anything. And it'll just stay there. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's running. So your service just doesn't work. It's like, well, there's some kind of bug that it's gotten out and it didn't die. And so you do want to have logging just for that as well. You know, we do use logs for audit trails and other forensic data sometimes. Typically, that's better handled with business rules and, you know, cramming stuff in a database. Because at that point, you're going to want to actually search. But sometimes at a low enough level, you may not be able to, you know, spin up a database connection, or it may be undesirable. Like if you're doing real-time processing, you're not writing to a database. You know, you might be streaming to memory somewhere, and then when the process is done, you dump it out to disk.
Okay.
Or something along those lines. Another reason you want good logging is so that you can actually troubleshoot rare bugs that can't be reproduced in development. I mean, you know, we talked about the debugger issue, but sometimes you'll get weird, you know, weird situations like, okay, well, you know, when somebody is, you know, connecting from Canada and their source IP address is in this range and these, you know, four things are set in their Chrome web browser and they're using this extension and, you know, like, and you can't reconstruct all those things because all you're seeing is, hey, it broke.
Yeah, I gotcha.
And it happens to be like the president of some partner company that's already, you know, mad at you.
So the benefit of where I work is we have state standards.
Yeah.
Where we have to use, like they have to use a particular browser for internal apps, which is what I'm working on. I'm not working on the external facing stuff that could be anybody.
Yeah. I mean, you'll get like little weird timing issues or like where you're doing, you know, a chunk of like five transactions and, you know, if any one of them except the third one fails, everything's fine. It rolls back. But because the third one's doing something weird and didn't get put in that transaction scope, if it fails, then you have corrupted data. And you get those kind of weird situations like that. That's, you know, it's a timing issue combined with an error combined with something else. And the only way you're ever going to reproduce that without just like trawling through the code and trying to test 100 hypotheses is to actually have logging.
Yep, I completely follow you there because I spent all day dealing with kind of a similar issue to what you just described. And yeah, logging would have been nice.
Yeah, it's funny how that works.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff that your logging framework should and should not do. And I think that will help developers understand kind of what the point of it is. Because the point of it isn't just I'm dumping stuff to a text file. Because you did that in development 101. And that's not what this is.
You should asynchronously write to your logs.
Right. In other words, it can't be in the main thread of your app, or probably shouldn't if it's a non-trivial app.
Well, you don't want it to impede the actual functionality of your app.
Right. And, you know, I've seen situations where somebody was like, oh, I'm going to add logging, and their logging method was very slow. For instance, they're writing to a slow external database connection, or it's one that becomes slow at some random point, and all of a sudden now you have propagating failures across multiple systems because, you know, Jimbo's crappy logging framework, you know, wrote to the SQL server that gets under heavy load for 1 hour in the afternoon every day. And so you do want that to be async, and, you know, it can't be impacting the main throughput of your app. Now, the other thing with it being async is at some point, if it's buffering that output somewhere, it's got to dump. And it has to do it. It still has to do it fast. Like, it has to be configured reasonably well. But this gives you a little bit of a buffer where you don't get immediately nailed. Another thing a logging framework needs to be able to do for you is it needs to be able to gracefully handle errors and preferably recover from them.
Yeah, you don't want a logging error to bring down your application.
Yeah, and I've seen that before. And the other thing that I've seen that's weird is where somebody will, on app start, they'll open the file that they're logging to, and then they just write to it while the app's running. Okay, that's cool. But let's say something happens. Oh, I don't know. You wrote it to a network share or something idiotic, you know, which people do from time to time just for, you know, because reasons. And okay, your connection dropped. So you lost the file handle, but your app is still running. Now when it tries to log, you either A, get an error that crashes the app, which is probable if it was written this way anyway.
Yeah.
Or B, it says, oh, I can't log, but I'll swallow the error. So no log will happen until you bounce the app because of the way you structured
it. Yeah.
Right? Like it needs to be resilient enough to go, yeah, okay, this connection dropped, but I can reconnect and I can recover. Like that stuff needs to be pushed off the side and needs to be handled in the logging framework.
That's error handling because if you get that error, you need to go, okay, what happened?
Right. But the same people that tell you that logging is just writing text to a file are the same people uniquely disqualified from being capable of writing a logging framework. And they're the ones that will most likely volunteer because they think it's easy and they can pad the hours.
True.
Also true. So you can see the perfect storm forming here, how that ends up working out. You also need to allow runtime reconfiguration of the log. And so this would be stuff like, I want to log at different severity levels. So as the app is running, you know, instead of just going, hey, write this log message, you go, okay, write it if, you know, it's in debug or if it's in trace or if it's this level of severity.
Yeah, okay.
Because you may want to like flip a switch and get heavy diagnostics when something's not working right and you just can't figure it out. But, you know, when the app is normally running, you don't want to flood the hard drive and, you know, get all that disk IO and all that stuff. So you want to be able to control that at runtime. A lot of your .NET logging frameworks, for instance, will let you put stuff in a config file that it pays attention to and says, okay, this has changed now. I'm going to load these new preferences and act on them.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
That way you don't have to ever shut your app down to get a log because a lot of times you can't.
Okay. Yeah. Because you may need to see why did it fail here.
Right.
But not shut the app down to pull the log and look at it.
Yeah, or to get it to log for the next time. Right? Because if you shut it down, well, there's active connections to the app. You can't do that. You know, somebody's money's coming through. So they're never going to let you do that. So you have to have that. And so severity is one, one vector to look at it. Mm-hmm. The other one is the area of the code because you want to be able to toggle things on and off. Like if you go, okay, I want verbose logs. Well, what's your app? Well, it's Facebook. That's not good. Okay, you want to be able to say, I want to see logs on, I don't know, the posting of content to new pages. And that's it. And like shrink that down so that you're getting a subset at the verbosity level that you want. But so you want to be able to toggle feature sets on as well. And you need to do those granular enough where it actually matters.
You also want to allow log rotation. You know, in other words, you only keep so many days of logs.
Yeah.
You know, the system needs to remove old ones automatically.
Yeah, and this isn't something that you want a server admin to be doing. You know, I worked at one company where, and of course, this is one of the first things I changed once I saw it. Realized, okay, I've got to delete these log files during an outage window because it was like 14 gigs, you know, and this was several years ago. Like this isn't now, and now would be bad enough, but you know, it's on a VM out there, and it's like, well, I could delete it, but I don't know what that will do to the load profile.
Uh-huh.
You know, on this box. And so it's like, I had to change it to do log rotation, but I couldn't even say, hey, do log rotation yet because I've got to kill this big file. Otherwise, at some arbitrary time, it's going to delete it.
Oh, yeah.
And arbitrary always means the when you're asleep. Time. Yeah. Like that's one of the dictionary or one, it should be in the dictionary as a definition of arbitrary, but it's not.
Yeah.
And so you really want that. I mean, the other thing too is you don't want to have to crawl through a bunch of data because more than likely if it's something that needs a developer to dig into, and it's not like a forensic type thing, which should be in a database and should be backed up and access controlled and all that. You know, you really probably only need like the last, you know, 3 to 7 days, and anything beyond that is just kind of ridiculous. And so rotating logs does that. So usually they'll do it. I've seen it done a couple of ways. One is to say, okay, when the log gets past a certain size, I'm not going to write to it anymore. I've also seen it where it's like, hey, write one per, you know, one file per hour, when one it gets, per day.
I got a question for you. When it gets to a certain size, what happens? Does it dump it and then start over? Or does it write to another log?
It starts another file, usually.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah,
because it's otherwise you're going to...
Yeah, I see where you're coming from on that. But you definitely want the ability to do this because otherwise you end up with other server maintenance issues. Because then, you know, hey, what happens when I've got to move this file somewhere else too?
Yeah.
Especially when you're in the a cloud type environment, which we'll get to here in a moment. The next point I actually wanted to bring up was being able to log to multiple locations.
Yeah.
Either concurrently or as a chain of, you know, fallbacks. So like if you can't write to the hard drive, you need to write to the database. You need to write to the Windows event log. You need to write somewhere.
So you need to have several stages of, all right, if this doesn't work, write to here. If that doesn't work, write to here, to here, to here.
Yeah, or to say, okay, write to all of them.
Yeah.
And get what you can. Because the other thing you'll run into is stuff like when you go into a cloud environment and you go, okay, I'm gonna spin this up on Azure, right? Okay, cool. You're going to write to the file system on that VM? No, you're not. And, you know, even if you could, well, it may get blown away at some random point. So, yeah. You know, presumably you can get around it at some level, but you might not do so well if you do that. It really needs to allow you to do the multiple locations, and you need to be able to change this while it's running, if possible. Yeah. Like logging should never interfere with the runtime behavior of the app.
And you should also be capable of being plugged in somewhere that doesn't require a lot of effort for a first pass.
Yeah. And so like, you know, in .NET, you'll do the whole dependency injection thing, right? And you can, you know, there's ways that you can plug stuff in to get cross-cutting control over things. Not just like, oh, I'm going to plug it in global.asex and globally handle errors, but I can say, okay, I'm going to have a type that wraps controller. And it is a controller, but it's an error handling controller.
Yeah,
you know, that makes sense. Something along those lines. You know, you can do a bunch of different stuff, but it needs to have some capability to hook at a deeper level in just so that you can get basic stuff up.
You want to do this without requiring a lot of work to support it for like the simple use cases.
Right. Because you got to bear in mind, you know, like if you're putting a logging framework in, you're in a situation that every single developer ends up in at some point, and that's where they come into a place, stuff is completely jacked up, there is no logging framework, things are on fire, and you have to fix them. Given that, you need to put a logging framework in place and get to some quick wins. You can't do that if you're going to have to write several hundred lines of code to get there. Like, you need to be able to tie that thing in real quick and get at least some basic diagnostics, because you're probably doing this in triage mode. I mean, this is like having a package of bandages that takes two hands to open. It's like, well, if you hurt your hand, which you probably did, when you're yanking bandages out of a package and it takes two hands, you have a problem.
You know, your logging framework must not ever exclusively lock the log file so that other apps can't read it. Otherwise, you'll have to turn off your app to read the logs or even copy them somewhere else in a lot of cases. And those cases happen during Black Friday sales when the server is already pegged out.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, when you open a file, you know, there's several different ways you can specify access permissions for other stuff, right? Yeah. Like, you can say, okay, I want to get an exclusive lock on this file. It means nobody else can read, nobody else can write. You should not write logging files that way, which a lot of people will do that because they don't understand how the file IO works under there. They're just going, oh, I'm just going to do file.write. Well, it's like, very briefly, you have that file exclusively locked. Now, if I have it open in something else and I'm looking at it and you try to get an exclusive lock, you can't.
Yeah.
Okay. And now I've introduced an error into the app by having Notepad open. That's yeah. Not a good place to be. So
would you have it set to when available, write to it?
Well, I mean, a lot of them will do that. You know, like Notepad, I think, will let you open a file that somebody else is writing to. But it doesn't, I want to say it doesn't give you an exclusive lock. There's a lot of low level OS stuff that you really, really have to know better than I do. And I deal with files all the time.
Well, just don't use Notepad. Use VS Code. It'll let you update while you're looking at it.
I mean, there's the file system level.
Yeah, too. Like, no, you can, just messing with it.
But you have to be careful on that. And a lot of people that try to roll their own logging frameworks do that because they're trying to get the simplest thing done that could possibly work. And that's something that could possibly work.
Yeah.
There's a non-zero probability of it working. There is not a close to 100% probability of it working, which makes it a problem.
That makes sense. And that leads right into the next topic, which is why you probably don't want to write your own framework.
Yeah. And everybody does this at some point. I've done it. I don't know if you have yet or not. This is one of those things. It's like, it's almost a rite of passage.
I've thought about it.
Yeah.
And I've looked at it and I'm going, that's just a stupid idea.
Yeah. Because most people's logging frameworks are pretty terrible.
Part of the thing is, too, I had all of your experience training me.
Yeah.
And I look at the whole concept and I'm like, yeah, I don't want to deal with this and this and this and this and this.
Yeah. All the stuff that can go wrong and all these weird edge cases.
If I were forced to, I could.
Oh, yeah.
But
the person that was forcing me to is going to be paying me exclusively to do that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to do that as, you know, at the same level of thought as I would put into cleaning my cube, right? Like, it needs to be, okay, yes, we're writing a logging framework because we're a logging framework writing company.
Yeah.
That's what we do.
That's different.
Yeah.
That is very different because you have, it's not, hey, we need to log this so go spit something out that'll log it.
Yeah.
This is our product and we put a lot of effort into it. We've got planning behind it. We've got architects on it.
We have QA.
We have QA.
Because that's something else people don't do.
Yeah.
On logging, you know, and that's why a lot of them are really horrible because what happens? Well, you pressure test your website, right? You go, okay, how does it handle under load? How does it, you know, handle when, you know, there's weird stuff going on with a file system or whatever, but logging code, never goes through that. Nobody ever does that. You know, it's not a thing. And so what you'll find is that when you go into some place and somebody has a custom logging framework, it's horrible. Like, you can pretty much bet on that. Another reason you don't want to write your own logging framework is because it doesn't add value to your application for your clients. I mean, yes, there's the maintainability thing and, you know, oh, yes, this makes it easier on the ops team and all this stuff, but nobody really cares, right? Like, you're spending money and time to build this thing that you're putting in the app, and nobody ever sees it. Like, the people that write the check don't ever see it.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, you're doing very low visibility work, and you're also doing risky work. Like, as far as, like, personal safety, like, don't do that.
It's also quite difficult to provide the flexibility that most mature applications are going to require when you're writing it on your own.
Yeah. Because there's just a lot of stuff. It's like, okay, well, I might want to write to a database. Well, how am I going to write to a database? Well, let's see. I guess I'm going to have to do dynamic sequel to, you know, have an option to, like, I'm throwing out an example, right? I want to have an option that allows them to dynamically, you know, have a bit of sequel that they put in the, you know, in XML somewhere that says, here's the template for writing to the database, right?
Okay.
Okay, cool. Yeah, but see, there's another problem because it's a log. What are you logging? Oh, I don't know. User input? Surprise, SQL injection through your logging framework.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
And oh, by the way, they may want it in T-SQL, PL-SQL, you know, Firebase, RavenDB, you know, Redis, who knows what they're going to want it in. And so you have those kind of problems as well. And you have to be flexible enough that you can do this without the developer shooting themselves in the foot. Now, obviously, if they're able to provide arbitrary SQL, they should be able to provide parameters. But if you didn't think about that, you know, about making it parameterized, and you're like, oh, yeah, they can just concatenate stuff and it'll all be fine, then you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
Real fast, because somebody will hack that. Another reason why you don't want to write your own is that whatever platform you're on has a logging framework. Any developer you hire is going to have experience with one of those other ones.
They're not going to have experience with the custom one you write.
Right. You know, it's sort of like if you owned a welding shop and you built a truck out of pig iron that you found, you know, various places and just, like, you know, welded it together and, you know, made this thing work. When you take that into AutoZone, they're not going to be helping you.
Yeah.
That's effectively what you're doing, because your hind end is on the line, literally on this thing, and you can't get a spark plug because you spot welded one, which you really can't do. But, you know, that's a bad, you know, the metaphor doesn't go quite that far, but it's bad. It's just not good for the company. You know, it's one of those resume driven development things. Yeah. It's easy to screw up. You have to think about, like, really stupid edge cases. You know, you were talking about JavaScript time issues. Well, how does it deal with time zones?
Yeah.
When you're logging? You know, where does the time value, when you're capturing a log, where does that come from? Let's say that you're logging in JavaScript, but you're pitching it to the server. Are we using browser time? Are we using server time? Are we using middleware time? Are we using database time? Or are we using GMT? And oh, by the way, when you're capturing to those different sources, one of which might be a message queue, one might be a database, one might be a file system here, one might be a file system over there, one might be the console log, which time are we going to use, and how are we going to cross correlate those things?
Yeah, because,
and that's, I mean, just one facet is the timestamp.
This is exactly what we ran into, was when JavaScript was getting the date time in from the server, then posting it, you know, it was coming in as a JSON object. Yeah, as part of a JSON object, and posting it through to Angular. What was happening is it was going through that controller, and JavaScript was going, oh, this is GMT. Like, this is what we got from the server. It's GMT. So Angular saw it and goes, oh, I need to adjust for the local time zone.
Yeah.
And that was completely throwing it off.
Yeah. And it's so easy to get those things, you know, anywhere in the stack, especially when you're doing larger apps. And I mean, like I said, that's just the time thing. Like, let's say that you're buffering output somewhere because you're doing async IO and you're actually trying to be smart about it. Well, what happens? Let's say you're running inside a Windows service environment. When you get the shutdown signal, you have to shut down very quickly. Like, it doesn't have time to dilly-dally on that IO. So, like, let's say you're writing to a slow network or you know, some network share somewhere that's slow, and you can't stream it out in time. What happens to that data? Do you have a policy that says, okay, I'm writing it locally to something that's essentially a transaction log, and then writing it to these locations so that I have something fast and local? You know, what are you doing on that? Like, how are you handling, you know, things like file locking? How are you handling, you know, there's just a bunch of little bitty weird things that can happen that you'll never in a million years expect. But when you push a logging framework out there, you're running in everybody's code base.
Finally, some things to think about while logging.
Yeah, we wanted to kind of get a few things together so that, let's say you picked your logging framework, you're smart enough not to write your own. Now what?
So you want to start off by choosing the right severity level.
So yeah, when you're writing, you know, when you're writing log entries in your code, in other words, you're going, okay, I caught an exception. What, you know, how serious is this? Okay, the user, you know, they're in the file dialog and they popped open and they tried to access a file that they can't get to. for whatever reason. You know, they could see it, but they couldn't open it, or we couldn't get an exclusive lock. Was that fatal, or is it something that we send the user back through and go, hey, yo, dog, this is messed up. You're going to have to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. You need to log that as what severity level it is in regards to the functioning of the application, the continued functioning. So you might say, okay, this is a critical error. The app is going to die. It's going to shut off. You know, like, I don't know, there's, you know, a hard drive got disconnected. Like, there's really not a whole lot of those things that really, really should be critical. Most of the time it's critical because you didn't catch it. But, you know, in other cases, it might be a thing of, well, you know, this is a little screw up and we need to log the fact that it happened in case it changes the way the program reacts later. So if you have if you have state issues, that's a great way to catch it, where you're setting state one time and then you partially set it the second time and then you react to the totality of that state.
Yeah, like with the JavaScript error I was telling you about, because this was for an inspections app, and what was happening was, and we're still in development here, but what was happening was they had these inspections had to be done by certain dates, and it was going over that date
because of GMT.
Yeah, that's one of those errors that it's a minor error. But by, you know, if we'd been logging, by logging that, we would have been able to go, oh, that's what's happening, rather than spending half a day trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
All right. I follow you. And basically what you're saying is you shouldn't make everything verbose, or, you know, whatever the equivalent of minor error is.
Yeah.
Just like you shouldn't make everything critical or fatal.
Right. And you'll typically see in bad code bases, you'll see a lot of the same kind of statements, because either somebody only logs in error conditions, you know, and it's like, okay, you know, you should be providing some logging that says, okay, well, you know, we just entered this function. If it's something that's critical, we just exited, or we're about to exit this function. Like, that ought to be in there anyway. But what I'll see a lot of is where people just copy and paste the same error message. And it's something like, oh yeah, something blew up plus my exception dot to string. And it's always a fatal error. It's really irritating when you have to deal with that, because you can't really determine what's wrong. You basically have a log file that cries wolf.
You also want to choose a good log rotation strategy. Ideally, you'd be able to look at no more than a couple of files to find the log entries for a particular day.
Right.
And you want to be able to search within the log to find the entry you need quickly.
Right. And that's why you don't, if you have a 17 gig log file out there that's just been appended to.
That's huge.
Yeah. Like, what are you going to open that in? I mean, you're going to have a really, really bad time trying to parse that thing and find the entries you want. I mean, there's tools that will do it.
Yeah, there are.
But you're going to have to go find those, because that's probably those tools tend to not be very friendly, because there's a lot of stuff that they can't do because of the way that they have to deal with a file I/O. They can't just pull that text file into memory.
Oh, yeah.
And then try to work with it.
Depending on your system,
and especially with our evergreen content. So if you're listening to this, say 20 years from now, maybe you can.
Yeah.
But the tools that tend to do really well with really big files tend to be a little bit shy on features, because the features that you typically use in a text editor don't work when you have a streaming type context, which you have to keep reasonable memory.
You'd have to be talking back and forth with the disk. You could not pull that whole thing into memory.
Right.
I mean, 17 gigs.
You could, but
But
an app isn't going to be written that way, because it's going to kill most people's systems, because it's going to start paging to disk and everything else anyway.
Like, if you're working on a server, or like your dev box.
My dev box would not take that.
Yeah, your dev box at work.
But even then, it'd be iffy. Like, happens really
what
weird.
I'm getting at is it's not going to, because, you have people like me with,
the crap top
with 4 gigs of RAM.
And you can't load a floppy disk into memory just about.
Yeah.
And I mean the big ones.
Well, that's thanks to Windows. Windows takes up all 4 plus some.
Yeah. So you want a good log rotation strategy. You don't want the kind of situation, you know, I know you deal with IIS, so you've experienced this. You ever had to crawl through the IIS logs?
Yes.
And it's like, oh, hey, which web app number is my app? And, you know, riddle me this. Let me go through here and try to figure out which freaking directory you even put it in, because it's completely arbitrarily assigned. And then I'll go in here and now I have the thing. And, oh, yeah, this app has been running for 3,200 days.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, you can look at the file timestamps and kind of maybe be right. But, oh, by the way, a lot of times the timestamps that are on the file can be touched.
Uh-huh.
And they can be off because, guess what? Some other bozo got stuck digging through the logs 1,700 days ago.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you never know if your timestamp is going to be in, you know, your local time, your GMT, or just some random time that the server decides it's on.
Yeah. Well, and here's the other problem that you'll run into, too, is let's say that you... Well, and this gets actually really into the next point, I guess. I probably ought to just go ahead and say.
I thought we were already into the next point.
Yeah, well.
I thought you transitioned into
it. Yeah, timestamps. Timestamps are a beast because let's say that, you know, Bob in accounting. There's always a Bob in accounting that has a problem,
did
right?
Did I tell you I met Bob in accounting? He actually goes by Robert. But.
Yeah.
Like, he's a really nice guy. Like, he says hi to me when we see each other in the hallway. He's a great guy. But. I met a Bob in accounting, and it was like
there's always the one
highlight of my day.
But it's always the example, right? But,
yeah.
Okay, he runs into a problem at 11:33 in the afternoon or in the morning. Yeah, 11:33 in the afternoon. Because where is he? We don't know. He's real far north.
Yeah.
You know, he says, don't you know a lot? Yeah, I just totally botched that. Okay, so let's back up. Let's say that Bob in accounting runs into an issue. It's 11:33 in the morning, but he's in the Anchorage, Alaska field office. You're in South Carolina. Your server, your web server is at a Microsoft hosted site. And let's say you're at the, I think they've got one in Houston.
I thought it was in Dallas.
Maybe Dallas.
They're the same time zone, so yeah.
Fort Worth. Yeah, it's Fort Worth, Dallas. It's Fort Worth. Dallas. Yeah, it's in that area. Anyway, so your web server's there, but the database server that this thing writes to is in New York for some reason. Like, oh, I don't know. Maybe you had a system outage and it's on the failover server right now.
Okay, gotcha.
Which time zone did the log get written in?
Well, depends.
Yeah, depends. Your depends are going to be full when you try to figure this out because you know something's down and you got to fix it and you can't find which log file it even is because you don't have a consistent way of handling timestamping and naming the files according to timestamps. What I like to do is I always use GMT in that because GMT is the same everywhere.
And that's probably why JavaScript assumes everything is GMT.
Right.
Just became a problem.
That and they're callous and evil, but yeah.
It just became a problem when it was displaying as one time as
the wrong time.
The wrong time. It was displaying as the right time, but then you save it and then you display it again and it's the wrong time because.
And then you save it and you display it again and you do that repeatedly and it's off by 6 hours more every time.
Yeah.
That's a fun one too, but. It's very easy to do this with log files. So I typically lean towards doing it in GMT. And then you go, okay, Bob, what's your time zone? Let me convert that time to GMT because I have an offset. And then I can look in the log file and go, okay, now it doesn't matter where the stupid thing was written to the server and who captured it. As long as they captured it using this method, I can get it.
I follow you. And I agree with that. I think that should be written in GMT because then, like you said, no matter where you are, you got one central.
Until you get a programmer that's an idiot and goes, oh, that doesn't matter. Let me just change this to central time because this is easier for me when I'm debugging on my dev server. When you get that guy, you need to fire him. Like, let's just say that I've had some personal experience with that little barrel of fun, and that is not something you want.
Well, you could just write one line of code. And it'll convert it to your local time so you can deal with it. We can write scripts to do that easily.
Yeah, or if you know what your offset is, you should be able to do addition.
Or subtraction.
You know, one or the other.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying if you're going to be lazy, be efficient and lazy, not
not
painful and lazy.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the people that do that kind of stuff, they aren't the ones that it lands on, which is
that's true.
Why a lot of things really honestly continue is people don't have skin in the game. Another thing you need to do is configure that system to give you a stack trace where applicable. So like if it's logging an exception, it should not log the message. It needs to get, hey, where did this actually happen?
I'm not sure I'd agree with you on that, because and this is something I've been dealing with all day today at work. Is
JavaScript's a little weirder.
No, this isn't JavaScript. This is .NET C Sharp. The stack trace traced it back to the mappings.
Right.
The message gave me an Oracle error. When I looked up the Oracle error, I found out what the problem was. That the object was built wrong.
Well, you have to get both.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. You said instead of, and that's where I disagree with you, is I think you need both.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta get both. I didn't mean to say instead
trace,
of.
Yeah, because the stack trace is very useful, and I've used that to find problems, but what really helps me most is to go into the inner exception message. That's where if it's writing to a database, the database...
Oh, you're talking about within Hibernate. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, within Hibernate. That's the terminology.
It kind of depends on what your framework is. Like a lot of times you'll see stuff where exceptions get wrapped by other exceptions.
Yeah.
It's like, I got an IO error and I wrap that by saying, hey, we couldn't get to the, this program couldn't, encounter some file error and we're just going to call it that to be nice. And then it goes out to the web interface. And it's like, oh, well, we're going to turn that into a 404, but we're going to wrap this other thing basically.
Yeah. Exactly.
And so you're going to want something that can actually drill down into that and get those other stack traces as well.
Yeah. You want to go all the way down to...
You got to get enough diagnostic information basically to go, okay, when I see something in the log, I should be able to figure out something that puts me on the rabbit trail to go find it.
Honestly, I mean, if I had my druthers, I'd just get put that whole thing into an object and then make that one log entry, and then I find the right log entry... I look at it. If I need the stack trace to find it, I've got the stack trace. If I need that message to figure out, oh, I can trace it to the mappings, but my mappings are right. And then I go to Oracle and I'm like, oh, it's a foreign key error because I've got the wrong thing set in my database.
Yeah.
I need to be able to find that.
And
I have not ever had any reason to need to do that.
Not in the last 45 minutes anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it's painful. Like, there's no reason to put somebody, because usually when somebody's digging through logs, they're already stressed. And so you want to kind of set things up like you would for a situation where any other situation where you know somebody's going to be stressed. You don't add stressors to that.
Yes.
As a fundamental rule. Like, you don't paint the walls at the psych hospital with scary creatures.
Just like when you write to a log, if you write an error, you include with it a gift card to Starbucks. I think that should be, we should write a framework where when...
Right. I prefer like putting a little bit of ASCII art that says there be dragons here.
That's fine, but there should be a gift card to Starbucks. Or where I work, a gift card to Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, there you go. No, but I mean, you do want it to be, you do have to bear in mind that a lot of times people are going to be digging through this thing in a bad state already.
Yeah, they're grumpy because something broke.
Yeah.
And then they probably got yelled at. They got to go figure out what it is. And I mean.
And they got to fix it, and they've got other work to do. They're still being held to those timelines frequently. So
to be honest with you, the debugging I was doing today was not something that I wrote. The developer that wrote it has left and gone to another job. It's just I am the most familiar with that code, so I got pulled from what I'm doing to debug it.
Yeah.
And
it's stressful. You want to be able to actually get an answer, and this is supposed to provide that answer. So that's something important. And the last thing is you need to find yourself a little utility that can watch a log file as it's being written. And for this on Windows.
Oh, I'm so glad you put this in here because I hadn't read this part right here yet.
Yeah.
But I was thinking this as we've been going through this episode.
Yeah, I use BearTail for this because okay. it will just write it. It basically treats the log file like it's console, so it just dumps, you know, as okay. stuff comes in. And so you can see things running live on your log nice. File. And I mean it's stupid easy. I think there's one on Linux, but I don't know. I've got to find something. Now, typically, you know, the other thing people will do in Linux is if they really want to do that, you know, the logging frameworks will write to the terminal. And so you just invoke it from the terminal.
Okay, I follow you
and
there.
And it just
yeah.
barfs it out there and
so,
you got it.
Question.
Or you can stream it to a file from the terminal.
Is there something that you can set up or is BearTail where you can set it up to where, all right, the logging for enter this function, exit this function, like normal logging happens, but I don't get notified. Error logging happens. Like
no, it's not that. It says, hey, this text file has been added to print those lines in here yeah. and scroll to the bottom.
Okay.
Follow it's you. Very low is ceremony.
Is there anything that can be like, throw me, like, because sometimes you'll have.
You could build something. Like if you had your logging framework right out.
For example, like sometimes you have something in an app that it'll cause an error and it won't break the app, but you know, it won't write to two or three tables. Not ever seen this. Never.
In the last 45 minutes.
Yeah. but you know, it'll write to some of the tables, but not all of the tables in the database.
Yeah. Because somebody doesn't understand transactions.
Yeah. And
awesome.
So is there a way or is there something out there? And this is just my curiosity because I'm still pretty new at the whole understanding logging frameworks and stuff. So is there something out there that will go, you know, because it will throw an error, but the error won't be a break it error. It'll be a.
Well, you can look at like the logs. You want something basically that says, okay, I want to filter the log severity as those things are coming
yeah,
in.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wanted to like.
You have it on your machine right now.
Okay. Good.
It's called the Windows Event Viewer.
All right.
When you write to the event log, right?
What I want it to do is
unless you just want it live. I mean, you have to refresh to get
what I want it to do is to shoot me an email if a certain set of like a certain severity level happens.
Well, you can do that. Most logging frameworks will actually let you, or most.
That's what I'm asking
because
I don't know much about them. That's why I'm asking this.
Yeah, there's a lot of error handling frameworks that will send emails anyway.
Okay.
Like you can configure them and say, hey. Kick an email out to the team when something blows up. You know, you obviously want to only do that for severe problems, and you don't ever want that called in a loop.
Like,
because I've had that happen a few times, and it's always really nice, especially when your Google account is tied to your work account because they use Gmail and you have to have the same login and do all that. Because like I've literally had it burn through the battery on my phone in like an hour mm-hmm. with. You know, some service and it's like, you know, you're at a party, you're at a house party and you've got your phone on silent. You know, you go out to the car and your phone is dead because it's been pulling all the emails. So you do want to watch that. But there's typically a way to configure it. And then of course, you know, there's other tools as well that you can hook in there for, you know, application health monitoring as well, instead of just using a logging framework for that. So it's right on the edge of what a logging framework is supposed to do for you. So usually you can get away with it.
Well, guys, that pretty much wraps it up. Before we close everything out, Will, what do you have for us this week for Tricks of the Trade?
Well, I want to point out, you know, the logging thing is valuable, in software development, but it's also very, very handy in personal development. One thing I've taken to doing over the past year is every month at the beginning of the month, I do a retrospective on the previous month and then kind of write down my set of goals. And what's interesting about this is that I can actually look back over that, you know, over a period of a year and see what my growth actually was as a, you know, as a person, as a developer. I can see how I proceeded towards different goals, you know, what my thought process was. And it really helps somewhat with diagnosing, where you're at, because it's very easy to be in a bit of a raw emotional state and make decisions out of it, at one point in the year. And then 6 months later, you look back and you don't really remember just how ticked off you were about something or how upset you were. or, you know, how giddy and joyful you were about something. And it makes it where you realize the power those emotional states have over you. And when you're actually able to look back over this stuff, you can get a lot of personal insight. And so I really like to do that. I also track my time for the same kind of reasons. I like to leave a bit of a diagnostic tail on myself so that I can see how I misfunctioned and what errors popped out of me as a human being. And I find that extremely useful. And I think a lot of people probably would benefit from that. So that's what I got.
Stand by for Titanfall.
If you have a question or comment for us, please email us at neckbeards@completedeveloperpodcast.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from Stand By for Titanfall by Pure Bells, available on SoundCloud and licensed under Creative Commons. The intro music for IoTs is Hillbilly Hip Hop by Jason Belcher. For references, show notes, and to sign up to our email list, be sure and check out the website at CompleteDeveloperPodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at CompleteDevPod and like our page on Facebook to keep up with the news about the show. Thanks for listening. See you next time.